At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking our focus entirely inside, moving into the world of the interiorscape.
Right.
We're talking about those lush, often massive plant displays you see in high-traffic public areas,
mm-hmm.
you know, malls, fancy hotels, hospitals, conference centers.
All those places.
They look gorgeous.
Yeah.
But applying pest management practices here is... it's arguably the most complicated challenge in the entire field.
It's a completely different risk profile. I mean, the snakes are just immense. We're not just concerned with plant health.
Not at all.
We're concerned with public proximity, air quality, and colossal liability if we damage, say, expensive non-target surfaces like marble or custom carpet.
And that's exactly why this deep dive is so important. It's a specialized resource we put together to help you, the learner, master this complexity.
That's right. This information was generated by Within Range Coaching, whose whole mission is dedicated to creating a broader and better agriculture.
And this is designed as vital preparation. Specifically, this knowledge is critical if you're preparing to pass Category B of the QAL exam in California.
Which puts a really intense focus on these kinds of public safety protocols.
So our mission today is to understand the absolute necessity of tailoring every single step from exclusion to application to match the unique situation of that site.
You have to maximize safety, maximize effectiveness, and you have to guarantee the absolute minimization of risk to the public and to the property itself.
So the theme here is meticulous planning.
Yeah.
Long before any spray gun comes out.
Precisely.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start at the beginning. The foundation.
Right.
Prioritizing plant health and non-chemical control.
Right.
So if these environments are sealed off, how are pests even getting inside in the first place?
It's rarely a single source, you know. Of course, new plants or growing media that are already infested, that's a major vector.
The Trojan horse.
Exactly. But we often overlook the infrastructure, the HVAC systems constantly breathing in air, the open doors, windows during deliveries, and frankly, simple human activity. Pests just hitch a ride.
So the first step has to be an intense inspection before anything even crosses the threshold. The source material really hammers this home.
It has to be. Check every new plant, every bag of growing media thoroughly.
And after that?
Think of it like a multi-layered defense system. After inspection, you build physical barriers. Simple exclusion tactics are surprisingly effective.
Like what?
Things like screens over vents and entrances, or placing containers in shallow water pans to create a sort of ant moat.
I've seen that.
Or even applying sticky barrier material to container edges or plant trunks to stop crawling insects. Simple, but it works.
I appreciate the attention the source gives the sanitation. It seems low tech, but cleaning is key. We know we need to prune infested parts or even, you know, remove the whole plant if an infestation is too severe.
Sure.
But the detail about foliage cleaning really stands out. Why are simple feather dusters such a bad idea indoors?
That's a classic example of an unintended consequence. A feather duster doesn't remove the pests.
It just moves them.
It acts like a dispersal mechanism. It just gently tosses those pest-like spider mites or scales onto healthy, uninfected plants nearby.
So what's the alternative?
If you need to physically clean foliage, you must use a disposable wipe, something like a facial tissue, and then throw that debris away immediately. That small adjustment is a real professional diligence marker.
And we can't forget the health of the plant itself. I mean, a strong, well-watered, appropriately fertilized plant is much better equipped to handle a low-level pest attack.
Oh, absolutely. Than one struggling in a dark corner. Non-chemical methods must always be the first line of defense.
Always.
We've seen biological controls, you know, using natural enemies, be incredibly successful, particularly in massive stable environments like hotel atriums.
And physical control.
A strong blast of water or just wiping. It's easy and often. It's enough.
But inevitably, some situations warrant a chemical application. What's the philosophy here, given the public environment?
Well, if pesticides are truly warranted, they have to be combined with those non-chemical methods to reduce the overall volume you need.
And the source material stresses using the least hazardous materials possible.
Which usually means opting for certain insecticidal soaps and oils. They're low impact on air quality, but they come with a paradox.
Which is?
The safest products often require the most meticulous application.
Because they're contact-based.
Exactly. They rely on contact and coverage. It shifts the focus from the product's chemistry to your application technique.
That leads us perfectly into strategy. If a chemical intervention is required, the source material clearly prefers off-site application.
It's the gold standard, if you can do it.
Why move the plant rather than treat it in place?
It's purely about risk mitigation. Treating a plant in a controlled area, a separate greenhouse or outdoors, removes 100% of the liability.
Liability associated with what?
With the public, building staff, and the non-target property surfaces. You avoid the mess, the disruption, the chance of overspray damaging valuable carpets or draperies. It's the easiest way to guarantee zero public exposure.
So if the plant can be moved, it should be. What rules still apply in that controlled off-site environment?
A critical legal and safety rule is that the product you use must be specifically labeled for that plant and for indoor, interior scape, or atrium use.
Or greenhouse use.
Or greenhouse use, if that's where you're holding it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just grab any outdoor landscaping product.
And post-treatment.
You must strictly follow all label directions, especially the personal protective equipment, the PPE requirements, and the restricted entry interval, the REI.
And that plant just sits in quarantine, so to speak, until that REI is fully satisfied.
Exactly. It stays in that controlled area until it is completely safe to reintroduce it into the public space.
But then you have the reality of massive built-in planters or huge potted trees, the behemoths that you can't just put on a flatbed and roll away.
Right.
That requires on-site application, which elevates the risk immensely.
It really does. And when you must treat on-site, timing is everything. It has to be conducted during non-business hours.
Late at night, early in the morning.
Exactly. When the public and non-essential building staff are completely absent.
And communication becomes a non-negotiable mandate. You can't just show up and spray.
No, absolutely not. You must provide timely notification to the building owners or facility managers about the application timing and the precise restricted entry intervals.
And there's more, right? You have to provide the MSDS.
Yes. You are legally required to provide clients with the material safety data sheet, the MSDS, for the product being used.
Let's pause on the MSDS. What does providing that document actually achieve in this context?
It's the ultimate transparency and liability shield. It documents the hazards, the cleanup procedures, the emergency contact info for that specific chemical.
So someone asks?
If a concerned patron or an emergency responder asks what was used, that information must be immediately available and accurate.
Failure to comply with these rules is a serious offense.
Just as serious as using a non-labeled pesticide, which, by the way, is illegal and highly hazardous.
That level of mandatory disclosure really shows how much this job shifts from gardening to structural risk management and public health compliance.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, let's move into the high-risk concerns. Protecting people, managing air quality.
Since the public is often incredibly close to these areas, the best precaution is their absence during application. That's step one.
But beyond direct contact, we have to worry about vapors and odors.
Always. You should prioritize low odor formulations whenever you can to avoid potential reactions or complaints from sensitive individuals.
The HVAC system, though, that seems like the major invisible challenge here.
It absolutely is. That central ventilation system can act like a giant vacuum cleaner.
Pulling in droplets.
Pulling in airborne spray droplets, vapors, fine residues into the ducts and circulating them throughout the entire building, far away from where you treat it.
So the risk escalates exponentially.
It does.
So what's the immediate mitigation for that?
If at all possible, you must coordinate with the facility to shut down the HVAC system entirely during application.
And if that's not feasible?
Then you must block off all nearby air registers to prevent intake. Post-application, ventilation is key.
Right. Get fresh air moving.
Open outside doors or windows. It speeds drying time, improves air quality, and rapidly disperses any residual odors.
Okay, let's talk about protecting property. I imagine the liability rests entirely with the applicator if a solvent, a pesticide, or even an adjuvant causes damage.
100%.
We're talking about permanent damage staining, pitting, etching on incredibly expensive surfaces.
That is correct. Let me just give you a quick scenario.
Yeah.
Imagine you're spraying an oil-based dormant treatment and just a fine mist drifts onto a priceless oriental rug in a hotel lobby.
Oh, no.
That's not a fixable stain. That's a multi-thousand-dollar payout, and the responsibility is 100% yours.
Wow. That makes the precaution step seem completely non-negotiable.
It is. Before you even mix the batch, you must protect every single non-target surface with disposable coverings, plastic sheeting, cardboard, whatever you need. It's an investment of time that prevents catastrophic financial risk.
And speaking of that overspray, air movement is constant indoors. You have drift from air currents, open doors, HVAC. What are the technical controls we use to keep the product on the plant?
The standard controls are critical. Low pressure application combined with using large nozzle sizes.
Why that combination?
It ensures that the sprayed droplets stay large and heavy. A larger droplet has less surface area relative to its mass, so it resists being carried away by light air currents.
This is where the technology gets genuinely fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Electrostatic sprayers. How do these small charge droplets solve the drift problem?
This is a great piece of technology. Electrostatic sprayers work by applying a small negative charge to the spray droplets, typically around 50 microns in size.
Okay.
And since a plant surface is naturally neutral or slightly positive, the negatively charged droplets are powerfully attracted to the plant itself. It's like a magnet.
So the product actively seeks out the target.
Exactly. This drastically improves coverage. It often covers the underside of leaves without you having to physically spray them, which is revolutionary.
And I assume it uses less product.
Oh, it nearly eliminates runoff and allows you to greatly reduce the required volume of pesticide. The one caveat is that the electrostatic charge diminishes over distance.
They have to be close.
They're best used when you can get relatively close to the plant material.
Okay, let's get into the nitty-gritty of the chemistry itself. Mixing and accuracy. Interiorscape jobs often require extremely small quantities of product.
Tiny amounts.
And this creates a hidden danger related to accuracy.
It does. Because you're dealing with such small volumes, you must have suitable, highly accurate measuring equipment syringes or graduated cylinders for liquids and small, precise scales for dry formulations.
Why is a small error here so much riskier than, say, an error in a field application?
Because a small measuring error results in a huge error in concentration. Say you need 1 milliliter of product per gallon. If you accidentally add 1.5 milliliters, you've just increased your concentration by 50%.
That's massive.
In a field setting, that error might be negligible. But indoors, that 50% increase can immediately lead to phytotoxicity plant burn or dangerously elevate the public exposure risk.
And the sources are clear on this.
They contain conversion charts, and they explicitly warn, never use approximations that result in a more concentrated mixture unless the label specifically allows it.
That precision is key. And on the safety side, you mentioned a critical rule for mixing.
Always perform mixing outdoors and away from the building.
No exceptions.
That precaution is simple and absolute. It completely eliminates the chance that you'll spill concentrated material inside a public area where cleanup would be complicated, hazardous, and a nightmare.
We focus mainly on sprays, but what about granular applications? These are often just sprinkled onto the soil and then incorporated. What's the residue hazard there?
The risk of public exposure is generally low once the granules are incorporated, unless the material leaches out into the saucers after watering or something.
So the primary hazard shifts to who?
To the plant care workers who maintain the beds.
Why the maintenance staff?
Because the soil retains residues. So anyone who subsequently contacts that treated soil to check moisture, plant new additions, whatever, they must wear chemical-resistant gloves.
That obligation for worker protection is essential.
And often overlooked after the initial application is done.
Let's quickly touch on phytotoxicity or plant injury again. We know excessive rates are a factor, but what else causes plant damage?
It's a combination of stressors. It could be the active ingredient itself, but often it's the inactive ingredients, the solvents in the formulation, or even impurities like salts in the irrigation water.
And temperature plays a role.
A huge role. That risk increases dramatically as temperature rises, which can happen quickly in sunlit atriums. And of course, the plant's own health contributes.
A stressed plant is more susceptible.
Absolutely. Plants already stressed by water deficits or nutrient deficiencies are far more susceptible to chemical injury.
And what about in mixed plantings?
You have to be so vigilant. If you're using a soil drench in a large planter with several species, that chemical solution moves through the medium. It can easily reach the roots of non-target plants and cause severe damage.
So you have to check the label for sensitive species.
Check the label and shield them if you have to, even from root exposure.
Finally, we must wrap up with the protocol for pesticide spills.
Mm-hmm.
Since we're talking about public areas, this is an emergency.
It is. The MSDS will have product-specific info, but there are standardized steps everyone needs to know.
What are they?
6 clear standardized steps, because speed and organization are paramount. 1, immediately clear the area and administer first aid. Keep people away.
Step 2.
Wear appropriate PPE. And this is the PPE required for handling the concentrated material, which is far stronger than what you wore for the application.
And the next step is containment.
Yes. 3, contain the liquid spill. You have to quickly form a containment dam around the liquid using an absorbent material sand, cat litter, specialized pads.
Then you clean it up.
4, clean up. Brush the dam inward, shovel out any contaminated soil, and place all of that material into a sturdy, sealable, and clearly labeled container.
What if the spill was on a hard surface, like tile?
Step 5 addresses that. You must scrub non-porous surfaces with a strong detergent solution, and then absorb that wash water, placing it into the same sealed container.
And clean your tools.
Crucially, clean all your cleanup tools afterward, too.
And the final responsibility.
Step 6, proper disposal. You can't just throw this material in the dumpster. You have to consult the local county agricultural commissioner or the water quality control board for precise local instructions on how to safely and legally dispose of that container.
Wow. We have covered everything today, from the diligence required for a feather duster to the high-stakes procedure for an emergency spill. The central thesis we keep returning to is that interior scapes demand an exceptional level of diligence.
They really do.
The job shifts from managing bugs to meticulously managing logistics, public communication, and serious financial liability.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the sheer number of required safety steps, the mandatory use of non-chemical methods first, the extensive public notification mandates, providing the MSDS, shutting down the HVAC.
The list goes on.
It all underscores that in the interiorscape environment, the logistics and communication requirements far outweigh the chemistry. The most crucial safety measure you can deploy is effective planning and timing.
And mastering these complex, compliance-heavy logistics is really a defining characteristic of professional competency in this field.
And attention to these specific details is essential knowledge for successfully passing Category B of the QAL exam in California.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive generated by Within Range Coaching. Stay informed, and we'll catch you next time.